Banded together from remote galaxies are 13 of the most sinister villains of all time, the Legion of Doom. Dedicated to a single objective, the conquest of the universe. Only one group dares to challenge this intergalactic threat.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
The Fire and Water Network proudly presents
JLU Cast.
Hello and welcome to JLU Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, Cindy Franklin.
And I'm Chris Franklin, and welcome to our coverage of Justice League Unlimited Season 3, the final season of Justice League Unlimited. Yes, we've left behind the morally challenging questions raised by the now-completed Cadmus arc, and it's time to have some good old-fashioned superhero versus supervillain fun with the Legion of Doom. Or is it time for that? More on that later, but first let's get into our episode info and plot synopsis of the Season 3 premiere episode, I Am Legion. I Am Legion originally aired September 17, 2005, just about 2 months after Epilogue.
Okay.
In the credits, we had a story written by Dwayne McDuffie, directed by Joaquin Dos Santos, with music by Christopher Carter. The cast was George Newbern as Superman, Maria Canales as Shiera and Fire, Michael Rosenbaum as The Flash, Dr. Polaris, and an officer, Clancy Brown as Lex Luthor, Powers Booth as Gorilla Grodd, Corey Burton as Brainiac, The Key, and Aztec, Scott Patterson as Special Agent King Faraday, Seymour Cassell as Chuck Sinani, and Takeo Fisher as Mersey.
While being transported from one prison to another, Lex Luthor escapes. He leads the police on a wild chase before being cornered against the brick wall at the end of a dead-end alley. Before the astonished eyes of the encroaching cops, a pair of arms phases through the wall and pulls Lex in. The Key, the villain who rescued Lex Luthor, takes him to a rendezvous with their benefactor. Deep in a dismal swamp, Luthor meets Gorilla Grodd, who introduces Luthor to his impressive cloaked headquarters and his new, much larger, supervillain team.
The Justice League investigates the site of Luthor's disappearance, and Shiera is none too happy that they weren't informed of Luthor's relocation. The authorities assure them they thought Luthor was no longer an active threat, having become a broken man after his separation from Brainiac. Government agent King Faraday arrives, announcing his new role as U.S. liaison to the League. Back in the swamp, Grodd gives Luthor a tour of his facility and pitches him on the concept of his new secret society, or Legion of Doom, if you will.
Yeah.
For a percentage of their take, Grodd organizes the villains in an effort to stop the League from interfering with their plans. Luthor is impressed, but not interested, and Grodd is both insulted and slightly alarmed by Luthor constantly talking to a seemingly invisible person and referring to himself as we. Lex tells him after achieving godhood, he doesn't care about frivolous criminal pursuits anymore. He just wants to find Brainiac and rejoin with him. Grodd, who doesn't want Lex acting as a rogue free agent, then produces his bargaining chip, a piece of Brainiac. From Lex's perspective, the sentient computer appears and reminds him that his entire program exists in every single piece of his body. Luthor agrees to join Grodd's group, but first he has to pass the test.
At the League's new Metro Tower on Earth, Faraday patches a call through from Chuck Sawani, the last surviving member of the heroic Black Hawk Squadron, whom the League worked with when they traveled back to World War II to stop Vandal Savage. Chuck has received an alert that the long-decommissioned Black Hawk Island has unwanted visitors, and the place is a museum of dangerous weapons the heroes confiscated over the decades. Shiera, who worked directly with the Black Hawks in the past, takes Flash and Fire there in a javelin, but as they approach the island, they are attacked by robot condors. Their ship is destroyed and their battle isn't going well, until Chuck arrives in his jet and gives them a hand. Landing on the island, Chuck warns them that his former base is full of traps and armaments, and the League agrees to let the elderly man accompany them.
The heroes encounter more blasts from Chuck's past, such as flying mechanical sharks and war wheels, but eventually make their way to the island's base, where they find Luthor, the Key, and ferrokinetic Dr. Polaris attempting to rob the vault. A battle ensues, with Dr. Polaris having a good time controlling Shiera's mace, with her attached to it. Luthor eventually gets what he came for, and with Chuck as a hostage, they make their escape, but not before triggering the island's self-destruct protocol. As Shiera scrambles to deactivate it and save her friend's legacy, Chuck activates another island defense, distracting the villains and allowing him to escape just in time to shut off the self-destruct.
Back at the Hall of Doom, Luther delivers his objective to Grodd, the Spear of Longinus. Grodd tells Luther that Hitler once believed it possessed mystical powers, but all he wants it for is a decoration in his office. Luther is furious to have risked his life for a knickknack, but Grodd reminds him if he continues to play nice, he'll get his piece of Brainiac. On Black Hawk Island, Fire is concerned that they blew capturing Luther to save a bunch of dusty old relics. But as Chuck and Shiera stand reverently before the statues of the fallen Blackhawks, Flash tells her it was all worth it.
Yeah, so after the series was picked up for a third season, showrunner Bruce Timm said they didn't want to continue down the politically charged, somewhat dark path of the previous seasons. Producer and writer Dwayne McDuffie suggested they do the Legion of Doom. And Timm reminded him they'd done the villain team thing with the Injustice Gang and the Secret Society in the original series. McDuffie meant the actual Legion of Doom from the Super Friends with a Darth Vader-like HQ in the swamp, with an upgrade to membership making them a small army like the Extended League. We covered the history of the major supervillain teams, including the Legion of Doom, way back in JLUcast Episode 4 when we discussed Injustice for All. But the short version is the Legion was the supervillain team created for the third iteration of the Super Friends animated series, debuting in the fall of 1978. The road to the Legion was a winding one. Hanna-Barbera initially planned for Dr. Savannah to lead a group consisting of many other members of the Shazam Marvel family rogues, along with prominent Batman foes like Joker and Catwoman, in a team initially called the League of Evil. But Hanna-Barbera found out they didn't have the rights to the Shazam characters at all, and only access to a few Batman foes, so the membership was changed and the team got a new name with the Legion of Doom. Led by Lex Luthor, the roster consisted of Brainiac, Bizarro, Toyman, Riddler, Scarecrow, Cheetah, Gigana, Captain Cold, Gorilla Grodd, Sinestro, Solomon Grundy, and Black Manta. Most of these characters, or a version of them, will appear as members of this Legion of Doom. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because there were rights issues that messed up their plans, and there's rights issues that's going to mess up the JLU crew's plans this season as well, including they couldn't use Riddler and Scarecrow because of the Bat embargo. And there's now going to be an Aquaman embargo that they're going to have to deal with. But despite the intent of the JLU creators for this team to be known as the Legion of Doom, some folks at DC forbade them from using the name on screen. The League is unaware of the villain team for most of the season, and according to series writer and story editor Matt Wayne, this is his quote, "We had planned to have Flash use it as a hyperbolic way to refer to Grodd's new secret society in the episode The Great Brain Robbery. You know, Luther's got some kind of, I don't know, Legion of Doom or whatever, and then we'd have the name stick. But a mid-level naysayer at DC thought the name was too corny and it must never be uttered. Despite this, press materials, including the DVD box for this season, often refer to the team as a Legion of Doom. Considering this was the creator's initial intent, we will refer to them as such moving forward in our coverage. Besides, the name has been used all over the place since because apparently folks at DC and WB realized that superheroes shouldn't be taken too seriously, and being embarrassed by a name like that with a group of long underwear characters is just ridiculous." Mm-hmm. So what do you think about it? Is a Legion of Doom really that corny of a name compared to the other names that they've had?
No.
I mean, it's silly. I think it's just ridiculous to, you know, just slide into it, you know? I mean, I get that they don't want to call them the Super Friends, you know, but, I mean, they're a bunch of villains that like to terrorize people. Why wouldn't they call themselves the Legion of Doom?
Right.
You know, I mean, they're not subtle, you know?
No.
If they were sneaky and subtle, but they wear outlandish costumes and make big spectacles of their crimes. Why wouldn't they call themselves the Legion of Doom? Anyway, the title of this episode refers to Mark 5:9 in the Bible, and he asked, "What is thy name?" And he answered saying, "I am Legion, for we are many." The original title was We Are Legion, but was changed due to DC having cold feet on the Legion of Doom name.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say the I Am Legion could also refer to Luthor, because in his head he's got two people. Which we'll get into that, yeah. So we start off with a police car chasing an escaped Luthor, trying to evade them. Considering in the timeline he had just been stopped and arrested, he didn't stay in long, did he?
Mercy now.
Just a few months maybe at the most. Yeah, I don't even know if he went to trial yet. You know, I don't know. I did notice that we see an armored officer thrown out of the back of the armored car carrying Lex, but no one is in the back with him.
you would think he'd be under armed guard.
Right, right. I guess Lex hopped up front and he just fell out due to the reckless driving. Because they show that the cage, the barred window was broken through, yeah. That Lex crawled through. So, yeah. While he's driving the paddy wagon, Lex looks over to the empty seat beside him and says, "What? What? I know. I'm going as fast as I can." This is our first hint that Lex is either nuts now or Brainiac is still in his head. And we'll examine this as the season goes on.
Again, though, my question is throughout the whole thing is how did he get his arms and his hands back? I mean, his arms, his hands, his feet, you know, all of that was mechanical. Well,
they showed him at the end being human again.
But again, how?
We questioned that before because they couldn't, like, I mean, the real answer is they couldn't, they pushed the envelope with that and they couldn't literally have Lex standing there with shredded flaps of skin and no limbs, you know.
I know, but still.
Yeah. When him and Brainiac merged and they actually completely merged and he looked like a combination of the two of them more than just a grotesque, you know, thing with Brainiac's chest and his head in his chest with tendrils, he looked humanoid.
Mm-hmm.
And Flash, like, basically destroyed all the Brainiac around him. So Brainiac had kind of already fixed him. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we talked about that at the time, but, you know. Lex goes through a barricade, and the wagon rolls multiple times down a steep incline, which is, why is that thing in the middle of Metropolis? That's really strange. Of course, Lex is able to walk away from this with just a banged-up shoulder, because that's what people always do in TV and movies.
Exactly.
Yeah. The cops corner him in the alley, and Lex is actually raising his hands to surrender when a pair of arms come through the wall and pull him in, as we mentioned in the synopsis. The lead cop walks up and checks the very solid wall, and he and another cop look like they time traveled from the early 20th century for some reason. Did you notice that?
Yes, the guy with the parted hair in the middle.
Yeah, he's got slick down hair with that severe part and a pencil-thin mustache, and another guy is bald with a handlebar mustache. It's like, what are these guys from, like, a circus in 1919 or something? I don't know. It's really strange that they designed them that way. Then we cut to the key riding what is essentially a Kirby-esque speeder bike through a very orange-hued swamp. And I like the color choices here. It's mm-hmm. very evocative. Key tells him his benefactor is looking forward to meeting him. Lex asks if the mystery man has a name, and Grodd walks from the shadows saying, "No reason to be insulting, Lex. I'm far superior to any man."
Right.
Yeah, so don't call him a man. We last saw Grodd and his organized villain team back in Justice League Season 2, Secret Society. He is once again voiced by Powers Booth. Corey Burton, who also voices Brainiac, voiced the key here. Lex basically says thanks, but no thanks. He's not interested in working with anyone else. Grodd thinks he can change his mind and activates a remote, which decloaks the impressive Hall of Doom, or I've seen it called Citadel of Doom, but I'm a traditionalist. We're going to call it the Hall of Doom.
Of course you are.
Yep. The design evokes the original, but steers away a bit from the obvious Vader ripoff.
Yeah.
The red energy lines running through it honestly make it look a bit like Kylo Ren's broken mask in the sequel series.
Oh, yeah.
And that was before, you know,
yeah,
way before.
Way,
yeah. Yeah, like 10 years before. He opens the doors to reveal an army of villains consisting of Dr. Destiny, Evil Star, Cheetah, Atomic Skull, Bizarro, Devil Ray, more on him later, Parasite, Giganta, Dr. Cyber, The Shark, Silver Banshee, Blockbuster, Dr. Polaris, the 1974 Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders, The Puzzler, I had to look that one up because he was completely redesigned, Queen Bee, Killer Frost, KGB, Sinestro, our favorite Gentleman Ghost, Black Mass, Charo, Toy Man, Copperhead, Metallo, Star Sapphire, and Rampage. Woo!
Uh-huh.
Some of those weren't actually there, but you can kind of guess which ones. Someone on the creative team of the series suggested this moment mirror when we first saw the Extended League in Initiation. And this is essentially the same story beat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because Green Arrow was abducted and brought against his will
mm-hmm.
to the Watchtower and strongly encouraged to join the Justice League. Sound familiar?
Oh, true.
Yeah. Tim said they knew this season would steer more toward the supervillain perspective, but with a talented actor like Clancy Brown playing their multifaceted version of Lex, they knew they could pull it off. This would be a nice juxtaposition to the previous season's focus on Superman,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, Tim brought that up. There's a nice little, this season is called Season 2 on the DVDs. We've talked about that before. Warner Brothers couldn't even get it right what season was which. which, you know, might call into question. Well, they called them the Legion of Doom on the DVD sets, and then they don't even know which season's which. So, but there's some nice. It's called like Justice League Chronicles, and it's like, it's not quite a commentary, but it's more or less a commentary on episodes. And there's one on this one, and it's worth watching. After the title sequence, we cut to the League investigating the scene where Lex vanished. Shiera questions why they would move Lex without telling them, and the cop says they thought they could do their job without the mighty Justice League. And her answer is,
"And yet, here we are."
Superman tries to settle things down, saying, "What's done is done." So you get the feeling the League is trying to play nicer with authorities after last season.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're still in damage control mode from, like, freaking shooting a cannon at Earth. You know? It makes a whole lot of sense. Superman has definitely taken a calmer attitude, especially considering this is Lex Luthor on the loose.
Yeah.
Lex flipping Luthor, you know, so. Which we'll get to this season. We also have the mostly forgotten character Aztec, whom not even Grant Morrison could make popular, despite creating him, writing his ongoing series, and putting him in his red-hot run on JLA back in the 90s. He uses his helmet and powers to see if he can pick up Luthor's trail, where Superman's own vision powers could not. The three heroes get into a technobabble conversation about how there are traces of matter phasing, and that's when King Faraday walks up and asks if they want coffee, because apparently that's all he's good for.
Yeah.
Faraday made his first appearance last season in Double Date, and now is the Attorney General Office's liaison with the League, another sign that the League is playing nicer with the U.S. government.
Right.
And we'll later learn that Amanda Waller takes over this position
from, at some point
from King Faraday. He's voiced once again by Scott Patterson of Gilmore Girls fame. Faraday and the cop Shiera continues to insult, tells the heroes that Luthor wasn't seen as an active threat because he was a broken man after the Brainiac incident, sitting in his cell and talking to himself. Little did they know he was probably planning the escape with Brainiac, whether Brainiac's really there or not. Faraday tells him to call the League if they spot Luthor, but he says his people can handle it, and Faraday assures him they can't. "You're good. Luthor is better." But he tells Superman he expects to be kept in the loop if they find him first, and Superman answers, "Of course. They are really trying to play nicer." And they should. So, back at the Hall of Doom, Grodd is giving Lex a tour and admits they are putting on more of a show for him, since there usually aren't that many villains there at one time. And I like that. It shows the differences between this team and the League up front. Although this season, it's going to always seem very full.
Yes.
Especially when they start showing the meeting table.
Uh-huh.
Everybody's there, you know. Grodd tells him that the villains actually pay him, and Lex guesses correctly that it's to protect them against the League. Grodd mentions, with the League organized under the Martian, it's hard to make a dishonest buck. Luthor calls it a protection racket, but Grodd prefers the term co-op. It kind of sounds like a supervillain union.
Yeah.
It really does.
Well, you know.
Yeah. Grodd admits he's not just doing it out of the goodness of his heart, which Luthor laughs about. It's for 25% of the gross. And the best part is, the League doesn't even know they exist.
Very nice.
Yes. Lex is impressed, but tells him, "We're still not interested." Grodd is puzzled, but isn't about to let him go, grabbing his arm and saying, "You're much too powerful a player to be out there freelance." And, you know, the thing with Grodd is, and I think that's something that you take for granted in, like, the Super Friends and Challenge, but something that they brought up in modern times is, this guy is like a freaking giant gorilla. He could, like, rip Lex's arm out of his socket right there and beat him in the head with it before he had a chance to even do anything. You know, and they did a good job with him on the Flash TV series. He's scary.
Mm-hmm.
Very scary. Luthor tells him he's out of the game, but Grodd isn't buying it, still seeing in his eyes that he's someone that won't play by society's rules. And why escape from prison if he's out of the game? Lex then talks to the invisible Brainiac and tells him that Grodd's completely missing the point. Again, Grodd is confused, but Luthor explains he can offer him nothing after he attained godhood and then had it taken away. But Grodd knows of his melding with Brainiac and how the League destroyed him. "There isn't a piece left on Earth," he says, "except this one."
Mm-hmm.
He opens his large hand and reveals a chunk of metal with Brainiac's famous three-circle symbol.
Yep.
Lex demands it, but Grodd tells him first he has to do something for him. And then Brainiac appears before Luthor, and we hear Corey Burton's voice telling him to do whatever he wants, since his program exists in every part of his body. Lex turns to someone who isn't there and says before a very perplexed Grodd, I could reconstitute you, bring you back to life. Brainiac answers, yes, we could be together again. Would the real Brainiac want them to be together again?
I wouldn't think so, because he's a more of a one entity show.
I mean, he went along with Lex last time, but it clearly didn't work. And I don't think Brainiac's the type of... He's always, like, pivoted. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever he's defeated by Superman or the League or Superman and Batman, the next time he comes back, he's a learning computer, mm-hmm. you know. He doesn't do the same thing. He's like the Borg, you know, basically. You know, oh, you're going to shoot me with a phaser? Now you can't. You know, that right. kind of thing. So I don't know if he'd want to be back with Lex, in my mind. So, of course, Lex then agrees. So what do you think? Is Brainiac actually in Luthor's head talking to him? Or has Lex really lost it?
I don't know. you would think that probably... There's a piece of Brainiac in Lex's cellular tissue.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that there's something there, but yeah. I also don't know how realized it is.
I don't know if we ever get an answer this season. That's one thing I want to keep in mind as we go forward. I don't remember having a definite answer in my head. I remember questioning it, but then the way the season ends... The quest to revive Brainiac goes in a totally different direction. And so I don't know what the answer is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it'll be interesting to keep, put a pin in that and see what we think at the end of this season. We also see the Thinker, Sonar, Heatwave, Weather Wizard, and Major Disaster during the sequence, or even a few more villains. We then cut to an elderly but still very spry and strong man chopping wood. His wife, Marzi, calls him from the porch. Your old footlocker's beeping. this elderly man, Chuck, goes to the attic and opens his footlocker, assuring his wife that, unlike her initial thought, this is no smoke alarm. He moves things out of the way, including a very familiar-looking jacket, picks up his old communication device, and confirms there's trouble on Black Hawk Island. I remember being like, oh, wow, they're going back to Black Hawk.
Yeah,
this is cool. Chuck here is voiced by Seymour Cassell, a favorite of director John Cassavetes in his younger years and Wes Anderson in his later years. In addition to films from those directors, he also appeared as a goon in two episodes of the Adam West Batman TV series, played Sam Ketchum in Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy, and incredibly, somehow, is the person who gave Slash from Guns N' Roses his famous nickname.
Huh?
I have no idea. That's out there in several places. I don't know how he knew Guns N' Roses. I don't know how he was involved with Guns N' Roses. But he gave Slash his nickname. Sounds like a really interesting guy. He passed away a few years ago. Takeo Fisher, who voices Chuck's wife, Marzi, has appeared in live action in films such as Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, Memoirs of a Geisha, Moneyball, and The Pursuit of Happiness. She also provided voice work for Batman the Animated Series, Batman Beyond, and Teen Titans. We then cut to our first look at the Metro Tower. We saw a different version of this headquarters in Batman Beyond's The Call, and Superman hinted at the League building it when he mentioned changes coming at the end of Divided We Fall and agreed to keep the League going. It's not super obvious, but if you look long enough, you can see the design is inspired by the classic Hall of Justice from the Super Friends series.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got that huge tower in the middle, but which is like the two... spires in the middle of the Hall of Justice and
right.
then the kind of rounded
swoop out
from the side. Yeah. And then the other buildings nearby make the other two towers on, you know, so it kind of works. Superman is on the watchtower in space talking to Fire and Ice in the Metro Tower on Earth. They confirm that Aztec's trail went cold. This is the first time we hear Fire, and she is also voiced by Maria Canales, affecting a thicker Portuguese accent since, as we'll soon learn, Fire is Brazilian. I don't believe Ice ever speaks on JLU, so there's no actor credit for her.
No, I don't think so.
Which is really strange. I looked it up, and I don't think she ever speaks. So, we should mention that this season, the regular Justice League actors pick up a lot of recurring characters like this. I don't know if it was a budget thing or adding two armies of characters made it necessary, but while we still get plenty of guest actors, the regulars, particularly Canales, Rosenbaum, and, of course, Phil Lamar, add some recurring roles to their stable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Flash is staring longingly at Fire with a big goofy grin on his face. But first, we must discuss the conversation Shira is having with herself, since he's ignoring her. She says,
You know what? This new monitor duty rotation isn't so bad. No more overnights unless you want them. Only one shift a week, and then you're done.
So this implies that the Leaguers had to stay overnight on the watchtower frequently before.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. But does the Metro Tower have a cafeteria? Our listeners want to know.
Well, yeah.
Who's staffing this? Who's paying for this?
You know, uh-huh.
You know what? Who? What? Do you have to go to? Do you have to go to a cornfield to beam into the Metro Tower?
Good question.
Or do you just show up outside and go in through a security door or something? Shire then asks why he doesn't just go talk to Fire, to which he says, "No way." And her response is hilarious.
Yeah, you're probably just be wasting your time anyway. I hear she's, you know.
Then it cuts to Fire leaning in and talking to Ice, with both of them laughing. And Flash goes from smiling to shockingly disappointed, and Shire finishes,
"Brazilian."
Flash's response is a flat, "Ha ha." Sneaking in a lesbian joke here was pretty daring, and I think it still plays okay. Do you think it still plays okay?
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know.
Yeah, as a straight guy, I don't know, but I do see this kind of humor still applied, especially to clueless lunkheads like Wally can often be.
Yes.
So, you know, again, it's another one of those very adult type jokes that they sneak in, the kids wouldn't notice. Yeah. Shire is going to tell Fire for Wally, but he speeds in front of her and stops her, and she says,
"You are so very sad."
Why is she so interested in playing matchmaker, you think?
Something to do.
Yeah, really?
Oh, yeah. It's just something to do. Kind of like, okay.
Do you think it's because she, later Wally says he thinks of her as a big sister. Is it because she thinks of him as her little brother?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Faraday appears on the monitor and patches the call through from Chuck. Faraday refers to Shire as Hot Girl, which is interesting. He said earlier he was briefed on all the Leaguers, knowing even who Aztec was. So wouldn't he know Shire doesn't go by that anymore? Is that a slight Thanagarian hate thing? Or do you think it's just because that's how Chuck knew her?
It's how she's known. The Shire is something recent.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know how to take that. But it is like, she's like, you know, don't call me that type thing. You know, just like. Chuck tells her, "We met a while back, ma'am. Longer for me than you. When you traveled in time to World War II, you fought alongside my squadron." She then says,
"You're one of the Blackhawks."
But the creators pulled a check off here because Chuck wasn't in The Savage Time.
Mm-mm. That's what you said at the time. We watched this.
Yeah, I had to go back and look for sure, but all we ever see is Blackhawk himself, Hendrickson, Olaf, and Andre. Now, it's possible Chuck was on Blackhawk Island when Superman, Shire, and Flash were there, but we never see him. We never see anybody but those four.
Yeah.
So it really is like Chekhov and Space Seed to Wrath of Khan. It's Chuckoff.
Oh. You are such a dad. Good heavens.
Yeah, I am. Chuck was an early member of the team back in the Quality Comics days of the 40s and remained throughout the various soft and hard reboots of the series. I saw one wiki entry saying he was a creation of Howard Chaykin in the late 80s, but that's not true, so don't believe that. Don't believe everything you read in a wiki, you know.
No.
Chuck was perhaps the biggest victim of the infamous experiment to turn the Blackhawks into costumed superheroes in 1967. Since he was always portrayed as the team's communications expert, which does tie into this, he was given the code name The Listener. Now, that code name's fine. But what isn't fine is his costume consisting of pajamas with drawings of ears all over them.
You're kidding.
No! They're horrible.
Oh, that's terrible.
And the whole thing was, they did this horrible thing, it had the Justice League show up and talk to the president, and basically the Blackhawks are washed up, you know. Somebody's got to do something about them. You know, and they were on the cover saying, "You guys are washed up and has-beens," and it was Bob Haney was involved. It's they gave them all these stupid costumes and code names and... It's one of the most notoriously bad, you know, moves ever in comics.
Ugh.
And it didn't last any amount of time. And a few issues before the title was canceled for the first time, after, you know, a 25 year run, they went back to normal, but it still got canceled. So, yeah. Chuck confirms that he's the last of the Blackhawks and that an alarm has sounded on Blackhawk Island. They collected and confiscated weapons over the decades. And a lot of it, as he put it, was real sci-fi stuff. So it could be someone trying to rob the decommissioned island's armory. I like the hint that the squadron kept fighting after the war and had adventures that became increasingly more sci-fi and wacky just like the comics portray.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, they, as time went on, they became, even like early, I mean, I went back and looked at some of the covers, and I mean, there was some wacky stuff. It wasn't just in the 60s. Like, there was sci-fi stuff happening, like, in the late 40s. I mean, it didn't take long, you know. Once the war was over, they had to do something with them, so. But at one time, Black Hawk actually was outselling Superman. It was another one of those comics that was like, it was a really super popular. It was a really super popular book. And they had a movie serial with Kirk Allen. Mm-hmm. And they had a radio show. And I mean, it was big. It was a big deal. And of course, they were owned and published by Quality. But DC bought Quality. And that was one of the only title, well, the only ongoing character title that DC just, they never missed a month. They went from Quality straight to DC.
Oh, okay.
Publishing it. Yeah. Shara tells Flash to pick a third, and he hems and haws, and after apparently a Thanagarian curse word, she says,
"Fire, we got a mission. Let's go."
Yeah. I wonder what that word meant in Thanagarian. We cut to Chuck's barn, and he opens the door to reveal a small jet as we hear the Black Hawk theme from the Savage Time play. Marzi walks in, and he tells her he's not going to argue about this. She says,
"I'm not going to argue. It gets cold up there."
And hands him his Black Hawk jacket complete with insignia. It's a really cool, stirring moment.
It's one of those cases. I mean, you know, do you want your husband to go do this? No. But do you support him? Yes.
Right. And, you know, Marzi's of Asian descent, so you kind of, you know, you almost wonder, did he meet her during the war? You know, or, you know, where, I don't know exactly where Black Hawk Island is, you know.
Right.
I don't know if they ever said exactly where it was, so, you know, but it's, that's, it probably met her on an adventure of some kind, I'm sure. So she probably, she wasn't like he met her like at some bar after he retired.
No, she
knew who he was and what he had done, so. We only spend a few minutes with Chuck and Marzi, but I instantly want more with these two.
I mean, they're a long established couple that love each other and support each other.
Yeah, yeah. I would watch a Chuck and Marzi series.
Episode, at least.
There's a nice transition from that hawk head symbol on the back of Chuck's jacket to a real hawk flying above Black Hawk Island. Luthor, the Key, and Dr. Polaris are trying to break into a hidden iron door. The Key uses his key gun to turn the wheel and open the door. But Dr. Polaris could have done that too.
Yeah.
Obviously. The Key was a JLA villain first introduced in Justice League of America number 42, December 1965, created by editor Julius Schwartz, writer Gardner Fox, and artist Mike Sikowski. There had been an earlier Key who fought the Justice Society in their last Golden Age adventure in All-Star Comics number 57, February-March 1951, and he was shown wearing Key-like headgear on the splash page, but never in the story. So the Key was kind of like potential that was later developed into the Silver Age. He reappeared frequently throughout the original JLA run and is probably most famous for being the villain in the oft-reprinted story The Man Who Murdered Santa Claus from JLA number 110, March-April 1974, which surprisingly is a Christmas story, you know. That was the first story to feature Jon Stewart as Green Lantern with the League.
Okay.
The Key was later reimagined by Grant Morrison during his JLA run, but the original had the distinction of being one of the few villains released as figures in Ideal series of static JLA figures in 1966.
Yep.
So he's one of those characters. I don't have that one. I should. The only villain I got is the Joker. Dr. Polaris was primarily a Green Lantern foe, debuting in Green Lantern Volume 2, number 21, June 1963, created by Schwartz, writer John Broom, and artist Gil Kane. Just in case you're wondering, he beat Magneto to print by 3 months.
I know, you were talking, you were looking, trying to find out what the deal was there.
And in the story is like called something like The Master of Magnetism or something. The Man Who Mastered Magnetism, isn't
it? Yeah.
So, you know, what's Magneto called? Master of Magnetism. Yeah. He appeared in Green Lantern stories throughout the pre-Crisis era, and post-Crisis was reimagined as a much more powerful menace, complete with an extreme makeover which made it into Kenner's Total Justice line in the 90s. So they both have action figure distinctions there. Lexus switched out of his prison orange for an updated version of the suit he wore in Injustice for All, but this time it's a much more subdued combination of light and dark olive greens. It makes sense on this island mission, but he continues to wear it for the rest of the series. Which is odd, considering the first version was purple and green based on his look popularized in Challenge of the Super Friends. So I wonder why they changed this.
Just maybe, I don't know. I liked the purple.
I did too. I mean, that just seems more Lex Luthor-like. Mm. Now, they made figures of, you know, the purple and green, this one, and then Lex in his orange.
Yeah.
His orange, you know, orange is the new black look. Yeah. They break in, but activate a very Iron Giant-like sentry robot.
Yep, I said that just as soon as it walked through the door.
Yeah, I'm no Black Hawk expert, but just scanning Mike's Amazing World of Comics, which we owe a great debt to, and very sorry to hear of Mike's passing, but his legacy lives on through his website. This robot may be based on the Metal Cyclops from Black Hawk issue 120, January 1958, because he's got one big eye in the middle.
Okay.
So, in the Javelin flight to the island, Fire gets out of her seat and walks up to the Flash. All that's in the frame is him, her breasts, and her hips, which he looks at and gulps.
Very adult. Very. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Then she says,
"You haven't said a word the whole trip."
And then Flash reacts with a gulp as we cut to a shot over her shoulder, down into her cleavage, and onto him. And uh-huh. She's just wearing this halter top. What do you call that? A bustier.
Yes.
She's wearing a bustier. Uh-huh. And she doesn't have the jacket like in the comics.
Uh-uh.
It's just a bustier and a pair of tight pants.
Uh-huh.
And gloves and a headband.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you think of this?
I was like, oh.
Flash continues to mumble as she says she was hoping they'd get to know each other over a little better during their trip. Clearly she's interested, so Wally is really dropping the ball here.
He's your typical, he's one of those guys that he wants to drool over all the ladies, but heaven forbid if they actually came back onto him, he'd be like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, we see, you know he came across as a real horn dog in earlier seasons, but now we know he was all sizzle and no steak.
Yep, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Fire is disappointed and says,
"I understand. You're very deep in thought, mentally preparing for the battle. No time for women."
So Shiara tips the ship and drops Fire right into Wally's lap and arms. They briefly smile at each other, but then the plot has to kick back in.
Uh-huh.
So we don't, get anything beyond that.
I mean, Shiara is trying to do him a solid here.
Oh, yeah. She's a good wingman.
Uh-huh.
We should probably pause for a brief history of the character of Fire here. Since she's been prominently featured on two shows here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, we'll keep it brief. She was created by writer E. Nelson Bridwell and artist Ramona Fraiden.
Awesome!
Yeah, for Super Friends number 25, October 1979. She made several prominent appearances in the later issues of that series, which you've heard recently discussed on For All Mankind, hosted by Rob Kelly. She was one of the Global Guardians who made the leap from the not-quite-in-continuity Super Friends series to the mainline DCU with DC Comics Presents number 46, June 1982. Post-crisis, she eventually joined the American branch of the Justice League International, where she changed her name first to Green Flame, then Fire, under writers Keith Giffen and J.M.D. Mateus. She eventually adopted a costume very similar to what she wears on JLU, designed by Adam Hughes. So imagine that. It's designed by Adam Hughes, and it looks like this.
Uh-huh.
You know. She's also went from shooting green flames from her nose and mouth to being basically a green human torch type.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so. For more on Fire, be sure to check out Rob Kelly's For All Mankind, as we mentioned, and of course Shag's JLI Bwahaha podcast, where of course Fire is a huge member of that team. The robot condors that attack the Javelin are weapons of the Blackhawks' old foe King Condor, and we'll actually see a reference to him later. So, one rips the top off the Javelin, and Shiara tells him with the ejector pods out, they're going to have to do it the hard way. Fire flames on, and apparently broadcast standards and practices had a problem with her looking like she was naked, as in the comics, so they give her flame pasties and a thong. It's just like two fiery bits in the middle and then like this like strip down at the bottom. That's it. It's like, that'll do, I guess. I'm like, okay. I think that's actually more than if she was just naked, because it's like, now you're drawing attention to it. He's like, are her nipples on fire? What am I looking at? That's what it looked like.
I'm sorry, folks. I try and rein him in.
Yeah, it's like, I know there was some problem with Firestar on Spider-Man's Amazing Friends. They had to tone down her proportions over the course of the series because she had that yellow bodysuit with nothing else.
Yeah.
She looked like she was naked, especially when she was,
flamed on.
Yeah, more or less, yeah. She grabs Wally, and they don't show her making her hand normal like Johnny Storm often does when he carries someone. Would it make more sense for Shire to carry
her? See, I thought that too, because I'm like, is she not hot? Is it a cold flame? What's the deal?
I don't get it. We should have kept a running tally on the javelins they lost on the show.
Oh my gosh, yes. Bruce is like, damn it, just another one? Come on.
Poor Lucius Fox has had 15 heart attacks since the series started. Mm-hmm. Shara takes a swing at the condor with her mace and makes contact, but it doesn't just explode like a pinto like it normally would. So why not? We've seen her take out other things that were tougher than this with one swing. Did she forget to charge it or something?
I don't know.
Well, the real reason is so Chuck can arrive in his jet and fire on it with machine guns yelling the Black Hawk battle cry, Haka! So, you know, that was what that was for.
Oh, yeah.
Chuck's plane seems similar to jet models the Blackhawks used in the mid-50s, such as on the cover of Black Hawk number 85, February 1955. I went through a lot of Black Hawk covers.
Yeah, in this I get that.
Yeah, yeah. So, Black Hawk's a series I'd like to get into. I think the quality books are on archive.org. I need to look into those. I need to know more. This is getting me excited. Flash tells Fire she needs to help Shiera and drop him. She hesitates, but he convinces her, even though he doesn't have a plan on how to keep from smashing into the island or the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, guys, you might want to install, I don't know, parachutes?
Something?
Yeah.
You know?
I know they had escape pods, but, you know, a simple parachute would suffice. Fire actually saves Shiera, blasting through the condor, which, as you pointed out, is a nice touch.
Yes.
Because she doesn't get to be...
That, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Shiera is one of my favorite characters. She's a true badass. But at the same time, she can't win it every time.
It's like Batman.
Exactly.
We want to see somebody help Batman out every once in a while.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Later on the island, Shiera is giving Fire crap about dropping the missing Flash. She says,
he's a senior member of the team.
Which means the original seven get to boss everyone else around.
Yeah.
Even if it's something stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. You know, Flash is like, I want you to open the airlock. But everybody's in there. Open the airlock right now. We'll all die. Open it. You know, it's just like, you know. The Flash appears off the cliff, rotating his arms at super speed, essentially making two tornadoes, which we've seen him do in the comics.
Yes.
He says he's like a helicopter, but crashes behind them, humorously with his chin in the ground and his butt up in the air.
Yep.
I'm not like a helicopter. Shiera yells at him for scaring her, and he says, she loves me. She's like the big sister I never had, only, you know, short. And Fire is taller than him, by the way.
Yep.
Which I like. She's very statuesque, you know.
Yes.
Chuck runs
up. You know, kind of coriander for Dick Grayson.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, she is. That's right. Yeah.
And they both fly with their hair.
And yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's right. And she's, you know, she's very, like, sex positive and very, you know, outgoing. And
aren't they models?
Yeah, they're both models.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Hmm. Good point. Yeah. Well, now George Perez based her on Puerto Rican. Of course, George was Puerto Rican.
Right.
But he based her like Puerto Rican women, Starfire.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of, so yeah, it's kind of, got that little Latina blood going there. You know, that's kind of nice. Yeah. I never thought about that before. Yeah. Chuck runs up and tells them with his knowledge of the island, they'll need his help. Flash is very dismissive, though, telling him they got it covered and that, no offense, he's a little old for this kind of work. You think with his experience by this point, he'd be a little more open to some sage advice from a veteran, especially after he worked with the Blackhawks directly, too.
But I took it as Flash just wanted to protect him.
Mm.
I mean, that's how I took it.
Yeah, maybe so.
I don't think he was downplaying him. He just wanted to protect him.
Mm. Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. But Chuck is insistent, and so good on him. He says something activated the defense grid, and if they want to make it out alive, he's coming with them.
Mm-hmm.
So Chuck tells him whoever broke in will be heading towards Central Control under their Victory Museum. He says, among the ordnance they collected, they even have a few war wheels, which we saw in the Savage Time. Fire thought all that was destroyed in the war, but Chuck says, don't believe everything you see on the documentary channel, sweetheart. I like to think the Blackhawks spun some half-truths to keep these things safe.
Mm-hmm.
Like they said, oh yeah, they were all destroyed. Meanwhile, they're like, you know, like pushing one into the,
yep.
into the island, you know. They were an international squad that didn't directly answer to anyone, so kind of like a proto-JLU in some ways.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So maybe they got a big death ray on Black Hawk Island. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, Flash, again, seems to be dissing a past he witnessed, calling their security system of war wheels and robot condors kind of goofy. But Chuck just replies, yeah, good times. I like it that he's like, yeah, it was crazy, but man, it was fun. You know,
yeah.
I saw some serious shit, boy. You know, just
it kind of makes you think of when, you know, when Captain America just don't.
They find the robot Cyclops destroyed along the beach, and that then Shiera notices they are being watched by security camera and destroys it. Luthor then activates some more defenses, including flying robot sharks.
Oh, Sharknado!
Yeah, well, we'll be here soon. These were weapons taken from the Blackhawks' biggest foe, Killer Shark. They have machine guns in their hammerhead-like eyes, but Chuck manages to take one out while Flash is running with him at super speed. The two nod at one another, so it's nice to see Flash is maybe figuring out the old guy has some fight left in
him. Uh-huh, and he's a good shot.
Hell yeah, I mean, he's like literally like... Like, it shows him, you know, he's like, the Flash is like running. Like, it's probably close to the speed of sound, and he manages to, you know, be able to, like, hold his hand steady enough to shoot and not with, a Luger or whatever the hell he's carrying, you know. Yeah, so it's pretty good.
And a moving target.
A moving target, yeah, and they're flying at him. Then a War Wheel joins in. If that is enough, a robot octopus. I couldn't find a source for the exact octopus, but a similar robot is seen on the cover of the second DC-published issue of Black Hawk, number 109, February 1957. The title of the story is The Raid on Black Hawk Island.
Oh.
On the cover, the squad fights off a war wheel, a robot octopus, and a flying tank as Andre says, "Somebody is using the weapons from our Victory Museum against us." Sound familiar?
Just a smidge.
I think somebody read that comic book.
Uh-huh.
The octopus grabs fire, taking her underwater and dousing her powers. Flash races around them, creating a cyclone that sucks the water into a spout, allowing her to reignite and take the robot out. He then points it at the war wheel, taking that out. And I love it when Flash uses his powers smartly on this show or in anything.
Yes.
That's all. Superman, Flash, anybody, when they use their powers and they're like, they're using their brain, you know, I like that. Luthor is irritated with the key, asking him why he's not the one breaking into the vault that they're trying to get into. And he says, "Grodd's not testing me." Nice answer.
Exactly.
The heroes get into the museum, and there is a great shot of them running down a hall full of costumes. I think I know most of them. There's a costume that looks like the quality hero of the Human Bomb, but that may just be a suit the Blackhawks wore on special missions. We get King Condor, Queen Killer Shark, who was a brainwashed Lady Blackhawk for quite some time.
Oh, okay.
For quite some time, she was like, you know, been brainwashed and was working for their archenemy. Killer Shark, and I don't know what the outfit is to his right. It looks a bit like a Chop variant, but we'll see in a minute. It might not be. I don't know. On the left, it looks like a long coat version of the Blackhawk uniform, but it could be something else. Then definitely Chop Chop's outfit from the Golden Age through the Silver Age. Thank God they didn't depict Chop Chop like he was in the Golden Age. Holy cow. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Oh, my God. Yeah, just no. Mm-mm. No. Bad. Blackhawk's later Silver Age red and green suit, the blue and red suit from the Bronze Age, and finally, the outfit of Zinda, Lady Blackhawk.
One of the best outfits ever.
Yes.
And I recreated that on a Barbie, and I actually took Kato's outfit from a Playing Mantis figure, much to Christopher's chagrin.
His hat and his jacket.
Yep. Are now Lady Blackhawks.
Yep, from the Captain Action, well, it wasn't a reissue because they didn't make Kato the first time, but they made a Kato to go with the Captain Action line. Yeah, and I don't have a Kato jacket or hat.
You love me.
I love you. I helped you make the sticker for her chest and everything, so. Yeah.
But she looks awesome.
She does look awesome. She's a really nice looking figure, yeah. Then we see the outfit of their ally, Miss Fear, and banners and a poster for Vandal Savage's time as the leader of the Nazi Party. I should also point out that there was a company that worked with Hasbro and DC in the early 2000s. I think they were called Dreams and Visions. Remember they made really cool, like, they made Black Hawk and it's like different outfits, and they made Miss Fear and they made Sergeant Rock and the Unknown Soldier. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
They used like G.I. Joe bodies.
Yes, yes.
I really wish I'd got in on those. Those are so nice. And they made the Black Hawk in his red and green outfit and his classic and Miss Fear. And I mean, they were really, I don't know if they ever made Lady Black Hawk, which is kind of weird.
I don't think so.
But yeah, those are really nice. Fire breaks down the door in dramatic fashion, but Chuck just walks up to the villains, including the key, who is holding a key-themed gun, and basically says, "Get off my lawn."
Yeah.
And the League just stand there. Why doesn't Flash just run in and take them all out before they can blink?
Exactly.
I mean, I know that's the whole problem with the Flash. And actually, I was just reading a World's Finest book where, new issue of World's Finest written by Mark Waid and drawn by Dan Moore, which, guys, if you're not reading that book, that is the best damn superhero comic on the stands. If you're a fan of this show or the Fire and Water Network, you're probably, you know, not all of you, but a lot of you guys are around our age. That is the closest thing to a classic Bronze Age type comic book that's out right now, but it's very fresh and inventive. It's written by Mark Waid. The art's great. Do yourself a favor and try it out. It's awesome. But anyway, the Flash shows up, and, like, he's got something else. The Superman and Batman are fighting somebody, and Robin, and they're like, "Well, we could do this," and then Flash just shows up and, like immediately just cages everybody, and they're like, "Or, you know, we could do that." And that's what the Flash should do. You know, it's just like, it's like the Flash showed up, the problem's over, you know. And I know they can't do that in a team book, you know, or team show too much, but it does seem like everybody's just kind of like, okay, we're here now, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Chuck actually says, "Whoever you guys are, you got no business being here." I do like Dr. Polaris' response. Sort of goes with the territory. We're thieves. You know, so yeah. Sarah asks Lex if they are going to do this the hard way, and then adds,
"Please say yes."
But Polaris informs her he's a ferrokinetic, and then really just starts dragging her around by her mace.
Yep.
This is not Shire's best, you know, show on
She gets her hiney handed to her.
Yeah, but she kind of needs it every once in a while, like you say. Key takes Flash out, and Polaris hits Fire with the mace. He raises the mace over Fire, but Flash throws a shard of glass from the case he just crashed into, severing the strap and dropping the unconscious Shire to the ground. Flash takes out the key, but Polaris is still chasing Fire with Shire's mace. Alex goes back to trying to open the vault, which he enters while Chuck follows. Polaris has Fire on the ropes, but Shire wakes up and tells her magnets lose their charge if you heat them. So she starts roasting him, and he loses his concentration, dropping the mace, and then to his knees, and then, of course, Shire rings his tuning fork.
Uh-huh.
He's got the big, you know, Galactus-type tuning fork on his head. Flash finally takes out the key and says, "Now, why is it you always find the keys in the last place you look?" Lex walks in with Chuck at gunpoint and demands they let him go. Chuck apologizes. "If I was 20 years younger," and Lex interrupts, "you'd still be ancient. Keep quiet." Poor Chuck keeps getting beating up over his age in this episode.
I'm telling you right now, I mean, your daddy's 85, and I'd still say he could kick most people's butt.
That's right. Lex activates the self-destruct, set at 3 minutes, and the villains walk out with Chuck. They are crossing a wooden bridge when he steps on a panel in a board. I love how Lex asks, "What did you do?" It's almost like, you know, asking a kid, "What did you do?" You know, or a you know, a pen or something, you know. And then flying exploding fish come out of the stream beneath them. Chuck manages to escape, but Lex says they got what they came for, so they let him go. And I like how Shire is determined to stop the countdown and save the Blackhawks' history, despite the fact that the countdown's now being down to 20 seconds. Flash says he can run them out to the water, but she's not going to leave. She's about to whack it when Chuck runs in and disarms it. Can't fix everything by hitting it.
I know, which is her biggest thing. So yeah. That's, you know.
Yeah, and I like that. That's, you know, because the Blackhawks, you know, they were action guys, but they were smart. Obviously, they were very smart technically. You know, they knew how to fly. They knew how to operate all these weapons and equipment. And, you know, they were a sharp bunch of guys. You know, they weren't just a bunch of thugs with guns, you know, or something. They go to the vault, and Flash pulls out the long deposit box-style drawer. What was in there? And the look on Chuck's face is one of sheer horror.
Yeah.
Which is great. We cut to the Hall of Doom, and Lex tosses to Grodd their prize, the Spear of Longinus. Hitler believed whoever holds it is invincible. So the Spear of Longinus, a.k.a. the Spear of Destiny, was said to have pierced the side of Christ on the cross, and therefore has mystic powers. Paul Levitz ran with this and made it the reason why the JSA never won World War II, because on Earth 2, Hitler possessed it. Mm. That's what kept him at bay. Lex asks if he's going to sell it to the highest bidder or keep it for himself and try to conquer the world. Grodd snidely answers, I was thinking it would look good on the wall in my office. Lex, of course, is pissed that he risked his life and sent him up against the league for essentially nothing. But then he laughs, "Monkey, I like your style. Give me the piece of Brainiac and we're even." I like that he calls him Monkey.
I know.
Which has got to piss him off. Grodd tells him, "Not yet. Today was just a test. But his next mission is for real." Then Lex is really pissed, but Brainiac tells him they have to put up with him for now. Lex tells Grodd he should kill him, but you won't. "No, not today," as he walks out. Remember that, kids.
Mm-hmm.
Keep that in mind. Fire points out how fast Luthor got a crew, and Flash does find it strange since he never worked with the Key and Polaris before. Fire is concerned Superman will be ticked that they let Luthor escape, and she says,
"Just to keep some musty old museum from being destroyed."
Flash looks over at Shiera bowing her head, and Chuck saluting the statue of Blackhawk, Hendrickson, Olaf, and Andre, and says, "It was worth it." So he finally came around.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So let's jump into our superlatives here.
Power action feature.
There's some good action in this one. What did you have for power action feature?
I mean, honestly, I would think it's kind of like a reverse power feature because it showed that Shiera can't win every round. So, you know.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to give it to Chump for shooting the machine gun eye of the shark out while Flash is carrying him at super speed.
Okay, I can go with that. Yeah. As for the actual power
action. My runner-up would be Fire, you know, saving Shiera flying through the condor. That was really cool.
Rotating chairperson.
So who do you have for rotating chairperson?
I'm thinking Chuck.
Me too. Yeah, can we give it to Chuck?
Yes.
Okay, let's give it to Chuck. Yeah, Luthor got the drop on him, but that could happen to anyone. Shiera was the team lead, and she fully respected Chuck and the Blackhawks, so maybe her if we need an actual leaguer. But let's give it to Chuck, because he ended up stopping the countdown and everything, and, you know, he got away from him, and, you know, so, yeah, we'll give it to Chuck. Plus, when we're going to get a chance to.
Exactly.
You know, there's no chance another Blackhawk shows up, so.
Justice League Communicator.
Did you have a favorite line in this one, Justice League Communicator?
Kind of like when she's like, "Come on," you know, Shire's trying to get Flash to talk to her, kind of like, "Come on," you know.
Yeah, and you're just sad. And I'm like, along those same lines, I love the misleading line about Fire. I remember it. You know, I knew it was in this episode.
Yeah.
"Why don't you just go talk to her?"
"Who, me? Talk to her? No way."
"Yeah, you'd probably be wasting your time anyway. I hear she's, you know, Brazilian."
Ha ha.
I hope it plays okay nowadays. I think it's harmless. No one's judging her on it. It's just the fact that Flash figures, "Oh crap, I ain't got a shot," you know.
Yeah.
That's what he's like, about, you know. It's not like they're saying, "Oh, that's bad." It's just like, "Oh man, I ain't got a snowball's chance in hell," you know. It's just like for a brief second.
Comic connections.
For comic connections, well, I mean, you know.
Good heavens. I mean, think about everything you listed off.
Oh, I know. In addition to kicking off the season-long homage to Challenge of the Super Friends, this is a love letter to the Blackhawks, and of course, a sequel of sorts to the Savage Time.
Right.
So it's like referencing like three different things, but man, so many cool. And it just makes you, like Rob's brought this up before, why didn't somebody at some point make a Blackhawk Island playset?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would love for somebody to make like G.I. Joe, Real American Heroes style Blackhawk figures with planes and the island. And I mean, that would be wonderful. Like all these different companies that make these figures out there,
uh-huh.
Valiverse and, you know, the Action Force and the Hero Hacks and all that stuff. Hey guys, somebody get the Blackhawk license,
yes.
You know? And of course there's the rumor. It's not a rumor. It was in development, but one of the reasons the Blackhawks came back in the 80s, the real reason, the title was revived. Steven Spielberg was developing a film about it. He's a fan of it. He's a fan of the Blackhawks. He was a fan when he was a kid, read a comic book. And he was developing a movie. It didn't end up going anywhere. Some sources say he made Raiders of the Lost Ark instead, but I think it might have been a little bit after that. But maybe made Temple of Doom instead. I don't know. But a few years back, it came back up again that he was developing it. I've heard that he might not be involved anymore, but it's still in some kind of development. So, I don't know. Who knows? You know, the way superhero movies are going. But this is not really a superhero movie. So, maybe it would have a shot. It would be nice to see, you know, see him get a chance or, you know, a series or something like that. There's a lot of potential there. for TV, movie, toys, you know. I think there is. I really do.
Electricity is evil.
So electricity is evil. I didn't really see a whole lot. Shara used her mace here and there, but a lot of times it wasn't electrified, and when Polaris was controlling it, it definitely wasn't.
Right. So not in this one, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think so. So what are your final thoughts on this episode?
I liked it. I mean, it was a homage to the past and homage to Super Friends as well as to World War II and appreciating your history and everything else.
Yeah, so. I liked it. I don't think this opener was quite as strong as last season's The Cat and the Canary, but it was comparable to the first season initiation, which this mirrors in many ways.
Yes.
We're not only going to get the Super Friends homage throughout this season, but also visit other DC locales and more obscure characters from DC history on the fringe of the usual superhero output, the mainline DCU. So Black Hawk Island was a great place to start. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really great.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWPodcast.
Extra special thanks to Jorge Luis Castillo, Matt Ryan, Neil Whitney, Jeff Owens of the Classic Horse Club Podcast, David Capoon, Rocket Dan Johnson, and our latest patron, Chuck Carvalho, who specifically support JLUcast. Do you guys mind flying to Black Hawk Island to help Chuck clean up? Mind those flying sharks now, though.
Now, not Chuck Carvalho.
No. Help Chuck Ciani.
Yes.
Chuck, yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to make him clean up on his first, episode.
Hey,
come
Chuck,
on.
You know, we did this episode just for you because you became our patron right before we did this one. And we say, hey, this episode's got Chuck in it.
Yeah, so perfect.
No, it's nice synergy, though, is it?
Yeah.
So next episode introduces us to one of DC's biggest heroes, long absent from this series. Just how he's introduced is very interesting. Join us for Shadow of the Hawk, and guess who the hero is? See you then.
Bye.
JLUcast is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises worldwide and is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders, and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue Mommy and Daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for JLUcast and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast. Please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to JLUcast.
Whoever's on the island will be headed for master control. That's in a bunker under the Black Hawk Victory Museum.
Where you stored the weapons you captured.
Yeah, there's some serious ordnance there. Even got a couple of old war wheels.
Wasn't all that stuff destroyed in the war?
Don't believe everything you see on the documentary channels, sweetheart.
War wheels, robot condors? You got a pretty goofy security system here.
Yeah, good times.